Recorded today's Monday, April 15th. Let the record reflect the time is 1:34 p.m. Today we have present Vice Chair Senator Reinbold, Senator Michicki, Senator Schauer, Senator Keel, and myself. Chair Hughes, please silence or turn off your cell phone. Thanks to those assisting us. We have three items on today's agenda. First will be Senate Joint Resolution 3, Constitutional Amendment, Membership of Judicial Council, sponsored by Senator Schauer. Following that, we'll continue work on SJR 5, Constitutional Amendment, Permanent Fund and Dividend, also sponsored by the governor. Time permitting, we'll continue work on SJR 4, Constitutional Amendment, State Tax Initiative, sponsored by the governor. I'd ask committee members to keep your questions and comments focused on the items. Concise and thoughtful brevity are the order of the day. At this time, I'm going to take an at ease as we are waiting on a few amendments. We're back on the record, and we have before us Senator Schauer and Mr. Scott Ogan, his aide at the table. The committee was given an introduction to SJR 3 on Fridays, April 12th, by Senator Schauer and his staff. We then heard from Ms. Nancy Mead from the Alaska Court System, Ms. Suzanne DiPietro from the Alaska Judicial Council. We ran out of time on Friday to bring the sponsor back up, so I offered that to the sponsor and his staff to reappear before us in order to give any additional comments before we move to public testimony. But before we begin, I want to address something that happened on Friday when we initially heard this bill. During the bill's sponsor's introduction, there was audible laughing and conversation from those attending the hearing. I should have said something then, but I didn't. So I'd like to take the opportunity now to ask those in the audience to please be respectful of the committee process and of the members of this body. I doubt there would be the tolerance for such disrespect in, for example, a courtroom or another place of work. So please don't disrespect this committee room or this branch of government. Gentlemen, welcome. Please place your names on the record. Make any additional comments you'd like regarding SJR 3 before we open public testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Schauer, District E, and I'll introduce my senior policy advisor.
Thank you. Scott Ogan, senior policy advisor to Senator Mike Schauer.
Madam Chair, I'd like to start with, for lack of a better term, call it a rebuttal. We won't take too much time because I know that time is of the essence with the other resolutions and things we have before the committee. But there were some contentions made, and I think we have pivoted from the intent of the sponsor, which is about the foundation of our country and our state, foundational principles from a constitutional perspective. Friday turned into it was all about politics, and that was not my intent, nor is it my intent. So we were going to try to redeflect the narrative back to where I think it needs to be, away from the political side to the reason that we are sponsoring this resolution. The first thing I'm going to do is have Scott go through some of the contentions were made about who the consultants were to put that on the public record. And after he does that, I've got some things I'd like to discuss.
Mr. Ogan.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. Leave the chair. There were 13 out of 55 delegates at the convention were attorneys. We provided you with a list of those attorneys. I don't think I need to go through every one of those. The Constitutional Convention consultants turned out to be quite a group of folks, and I thank Senator Keel for those questions about that. Ernest Bailey was a professor at the University of Florida and author of Principles and Problems of State and Local Government, Oxford University Press, 1958. Dayton McKean was a professor at the University of Colorado who worked with the committee on legislative article. Vincent Ulstrom, professor at University of Oregon, who worked with the committee on natural resources article. Weldon Cooper, professor at University of Virginia, who worked on the committee of local government. Sheldon Elliott was probably the most influential in this section of the Constitution that we were discussing, director of the Institute for Judicial Administration in New York, who worked on the committee as a judiciary or on the judiciary article. And just as a footnote, Sheldon Elliott wrote Collected Studies on Judicial Administrations, published by Ocean's Publications in 1959. In May 1958, the League of Women Voters in New York asked Sheldon Elliott's Institute to prepare a new judiciary article for New York's Constitution for introduction in the next legislature. And that plan was for a statewide integrated court system, centrally administrated and financed. So clearly this gentleman was had some very good credentialing. The last three were remained throughout most of the convention and provided significant assistance in many substantive areas. That would be Kim Burrow Owen, a professor at Louisiana State University, who worked on the Committee on Style and Drafting, as well as more generally. John E. Bebout from the National Municipal League, who worked on the Committee on Local Government article, and more generally, and Emil J. Sadie from the Brookings Institution, who worked with the Secretary of the Convention on Administration and Organization of the Records. So, in sum, I think this was a very qualified, credentialed group of people that were advising the Constitutional Convention.
Thanks, Scott. So, Madam Chair, I'll continue. And I want to point out that some of the counter-arguments made by the court on Friday, they discussed very succinctly the number of people that approved and opposed that constitutional amendment to have the council be voted on an up or down vote by the legislature. And it is true that most of them voted against it. It was 49-4, I think, was the number, if I have it right. Some of the consultants, though, disagreed with that, and I gave those quotes for the record, so I won't go over that again. My point being, as we go back to this, this isn't about politics, which, as I knew they would, they're going to try to make this about politics. This is about what I think is a small foundational flaw in how that structure was set up. And there are certainly other states that require legislators to vote up or down on who's going to go forward as a judge. Some states require an election, not just an appointment, so that they're held accountable to the people. And so I'm going to continue with a couple things. One of the things I mentioned that was brought up was underrepresentation during the Constitutional Convention. I thought some of these statistics would be fascinating for people to hear. In the early 1900s, the burgeoning Alaska Territory saw voting turnout by Alaska Natives on the rise. By 1922, it was higher than the non-Native population of the territory. In 1924, the U.S. Congress conferred citizenship on all non-citizen Indians born within the territorial limits of the United States. The territorial legislature responded by enacting a literacy law the next year requiring that voters in territorial elections be able to read and write the English language. The Alaska Territorial Legislature began passing laws limiting the ability of Alaska Natives to be citizens, to participate in the political process, and to enter certain public establishments. Alaska's constitution also included an English literacy requirement as a qualification for voting and was not repealed until 1970. At the time the Alaska Constitution was being crafted, Alaska's indigenous population was virtually absent from the discussion except for one person, Frank Perotrovich of Klawik, and the Alaska Natives constitute a significantly higher percentage of the incarcerated population as we go through the discussion. The point of bringing that up is that at the time, there was underrepresentation in all groups of the people and what they may or may not have supported. And the point I want to drive home is that a very small group got together, experts to be sure, but there was not that much representation, certainly from the population that was indigenous to Alaska at the time during the Constitutional Convention. I think that's important to bring up. So I'm going to go really quickly now.
And Senator Schauer, yes, could you relate that more specifically to the resolution as far as the confirmation by the legislature of the judicial?
Because absolutely, Madam Chair. The intent, the contention on Friday was that we were well represented during the Constitutional Convention. And I think that one of the things that is lost in the discussion is that the majority of the population during the forming of the Constitution was not represented except by one person. And when the court says that, well, in fact, there was great representation, everybody was here, most of the population was not represented at that Constitutional Convention. Would that have changed things? I don't know. But I think it's germane to the discussion since they added that into the discussion to counter with that, in fact, not the majority of the population was represented at that time. What would it have been if the majority of the population at the Constitutional Convention had been Native? I would ask it that way and see what might have been different. So just something to think about. I brought it out for that very reason, just because of that.
Yes, I'd make the tie-in, too, because one of your foundational points or premises is the powers inherent in the people, and
Correct.
You're trying to return a piece of this, the people. I just wanted to make that connection.
Thank you for doing that, Madam Chair. That's much more clear, and I do appreciate that. I'm just going to go real quickly down the list? I think there was a question.
Oh, Senator Michiki. Sure.
I'd like to talk about the bill and any problems we have today. I understand. I have ultimate respect for the sponsor. We agree on nearly everything. But when people testify with something, and I don't mean you, but trying to answer someone that answered something off topic, I think we can get so far off the subject of this bill and the problem it's trying to solve that you lose the reason we're here. I'd like to kind of move back toward why the bill's important and what it solves, as opposed to disagreeing with one of the testifiers.
Madam Chair, may I?
And, well, before you do, I just want to say that there were questions about the history. I had one of them, how many attorneys were present at the drafting, at the time of the drafting, and involved. And so that history is why they decided what they did. So with respect to your concern of addressing actually what the bill would do today, having a little bit of knowledge of, and I will say that Ms. Mead made it clear that this wasn't missed. They did this intentionally. They did have the discussion, so it wasn't something that was missed. It was done intentionally. So now the question is, did they make a mistake when they made that decision? And so that's what we are here today to discuss. Senator Reinbold.
I just have a quick question. I was gone on Friday. People know that I had to go back to my brother's funeral. But does all of this resolution do, is it subject to a confirmation by a majority of the members of the legislature in joint session for the Judicial Council? Is that pretty much it?
Can I give her a quick summary, Madam Chair?
Sure, very quick, please.
Through the Chair, Senator Reinbold, the bottom line, the resolution right now, there are three council members that are attorneys. There are three that are non, right?
Oh, yeah,
the three that are non-attorneys are required to get an up and down vote via the legislature. The three attorney members are not. When there is a tie, and there has been, the Chief Justice is the seventh vote. And so you have three lawyers plus one who have the ability. All I'm asking in this resolution, which is a scaled down version of a previous attempt, is that those three attorney members also get an up or down vote so that there is some voice of the people in selecting them. Because otherwise, as I explained on Friday, you have essentially lawyers picking other lawyers, and there is no cross-check all the way to the Chief Justice, who can essentially pick every single judge in the state of Alaska, because those go before the governor and nobody else is involved.
Through the Chair.
Senator Reinbold.
So the answer is yes.
I think so. I was trying to get it right.
Very
familiar. I didn't know what you missed.
I'm very familiar
so,
with
okay,
all that. I've been
that
around the block.
My apologies.
Time.
I wasn't sure how
so
much
yes
you were familiar.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Yes,
they
ma'am.
Continue.
Okay. And I will try to stick to Senator Michiki's point as well, because this is the reason that I want to rebut some of those, is because the argument of the resolution, my intent, Madam Chair, was pivoted in the secondary testimony by the next two testifiers away from my intent, which is looking at the constitutional provision and why I believe that should be tweaked. But everything after that was basically about politics and trying to contend that all I'm trying to do is to get conservatives. Things I did not say during the testimony were thrown out. Well, that's why you're trying to do this. You're trying to change. I can give you the comments. My goal, even though I was not going to have intent assigned to my bill, this is some of the testimony. My goal is to change who's on the bench. My goal is to get behind who's on the bench. Change the nature of the judges that go to the governor. And what I'm trying to do here, Madam Chair, is to make it clear for the record that the court's contention is I am doing this. This resolution is about politics. And I am here to tell you and rebut that contention. It is not about politics. This is about what I believe to be a small flaw in the constitutional premise, as I said on Friday. This entire thing is about the fact that we set up a system that three attorneys and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court can determine on their own every single judge that would go before the governor to be nominated. In one sense, you could call it an oligarchy. They have power over one-third of the government. That's the system in place. As I discussed on Friday, the people have been removed from that process. They tried to make the argument three civilians get on there and they're voted by the legislature. That would be fine if they could ensure that those votes could not be overridden. Our system doesn't do that. If we had a seventh tie-break member that was not a lawyer or was not the Chief Justice, perhaps you could look at it and go, there would be no bias. But the problem with the system as I see it today is you have a system literally set up where nothing but lawyers can choose from 0.6% of the population, the 4,500 lawyers in the state, from their own pool. They can determine who goes to the governor, and that's who sits on the bench. And one of the contention was about election versus retention. I need to make that clear as well. The judges are never elected in the state. they're appointed. After that, they are retained through election cycles, and there is a significant difference, and that argument was made as well. I have pages of notes, Madam Chair, and like I said, I did not want to waste the time of the committee to go through this to talk about the counters, but the reason I went through these was to look at the arguments made. I could spend time refuting them all, and I don't think I really need to do that. What I was trying to do throughout this was to pivot the conversation, and that is my goal today for my rebuttal, if you will, since we're talking law and lawyers, was to pivot the conversation back to what I think is the germane point, which is this is about that foundational change of how our system of selecting judges in Alaska is done. And it is not about trying to get conservatives, because I could say the same argument that it could be about getting liberals if I had somebody else on the other side that was choosing it. It could go either direction. That's why it's not germane to the discussion. It could go in any direction if you set up a system that could allow a liberal, when liberals were in charge, to have a liberal judge, and you could have a conservative when conservatives were in charge. It could work against or for you. That's why the foundational constitutional documents try to stay away from that argument. And I will make one last point, and I think this is also germane to the discussion. The argument was somewhat made on Friday that legislators cannot divorce politics from ourselves when we are trying to be objective and look at somebody that is put in front of us and determine whether or not on the merit-based system, which we support, we never said we don't support that system, they're trying to tell us that we cannot divorce ourselves from politics when somebody's put in front of us and we can't do it objectively. However, it was said on Friday that somehow judges can always divorce from themselves politics and make very objective opinions. So to me, that is not a two-way street. Either all of us are human, as they said on Friday, because they're constituents and they're human, and we are all influenced by our biases, or none of us are. It doesn't only work for one branch of the government, Madam Chair. Either we're all human and influenced, or all of us can be objective. That's my bottom line point, and I wanted to put those out there. I'm going to stop at this point so we can move on and open up, obviously, for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sponsor. That final point is very valid. It's a two-way street. I would say it's not about politics. I'd sum it up by saying it's not about politics. It's about accountability. At this point, the accountability doesn't really factor in until they're up for a retention vote. This starts the accountability out on day one. The other things that I thought was an interesting point was that attorneys are our constituents. They are. And I will say I love attorneys. My dad was an attorney. I have two siblings that are attorneys. I love attorneys. But they're not a class above any other person. And if we're not allowing some of these other boards and commissions, for instance, to appoint their own, I just don't see that they should be in a protected class where they can do that. And so it's not really about the possibility of a 4-3 vote. I know it was shown that's quite rare, but it really boils down to accountability and that beginning from day one. Are there any other comments before we go to public testimony? Senator Reinbold.
I just want to say this is only 15 words of change. That's all this is, that it's subject to a confirmation by a majority of the members of the legislature in a joint session. We do hundreds of those. This is a tiny baby step. I'd much rather have them elected, to be honest with you, because I think they need to be vetted. And I believe there's more political activism from the judicial branch than almost any other, you know. I mean, there's books all over the place about judicial activism. So to think that they can and do, I'm sorry, I've seen it one too many times, all the way up as high as you can get. So I believe there's massive, and I absolutely support this. I think we need to get it out as quickly as we can and get it on its way, because a little vote to confirm, you know, with a couple hundred other people is just a baby step.
And Madam Chair, may I make one comment?
Yes.
Just on your last comment there. I want to make it clear again for the record as we go through this and people listen. Lawyers are still picking lawyers. Mm-hmm. Nothing is changing in how the system works and the merit base and who gets eventually to that nomination position for the governor. Nothing is changing. We are simply adding one last cross check from the voice of the people, because that's where the power is derived, according to our Constitution, over who the nominees on the council are. We're still not talking about who actually goes to be a judge. It's a very small step. It's a minuscule step in the process. So, for what it's worth.
Thank you. Are there any further questions or comments? Senator Machicki?
Just wondering if the sponsor or staff has thought about how this would work mechanically. I'm just trying to picture. So they would bring three names forward. They would go through their normal process, bringing three names forward, and they would be confirmed by the legislature. If they fail, they start over, just like any other board. Do you have a contingency in place for the council continuing to operate if they don't have an adequate number of members?
Mr. Ogan?
Madam Chair, I would assume that could be done by statute. And although it doesn't expressly say that in the Constitution, but it would certainly, I think it would imply that they could appoint somebody else and they have to wait for the next confirmation, like many other boards and commissions and commissioners, that maybe they missed a confirmation window during the legislative process. But, you know, the resolution is silent on that, so.
Madam Chair, I'll just add to that as well. It's a valid question. We have discussed it very briefly, but what one of our struggles, as you know, with so many, what do we have, 60, I mean, a little facetious, 60 constitutional amendments in front of us this year, one after another. We are trying to stay at the highest level of this and look at that foundational change and not get into the level of statutes, how they would be written, policies, et cetera. We're trying to refrain from that to the broader topics, the top end of this and that foundational document, and then let the actual work of statutes and other things come to it if it was to pass, because there are procedures for that. We just didn't want to get to that level with this constitutional change.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. All right, seeing no other comments or questions before us, I'm going to open public testimony. And we're going to limit this to 1 minute because we have a number of callers, and if you could please indicate at the beginning of your, after you state your name for the record, if you could indicate at the beginning whether you support or oppose SGR 3, that'd be very helpful. And I know sticking to a minute might be hard on a subject like this, but I think you can do it. And that way we can get to everyone because we have a number of pieces of legislation before us today. So we will start with the person who signed in first, and that is Heather Arnett. Welcome to Senate Judiciary. Please state your name for the record. Indicate at the beginning of your testimony whether you support or oppose SGR 3. Oh, I'm sorry. You had no by your name. I'm sorry for calling you. So next we will go to Eleanor Andrews. Welcome to Senate Judiciary. Please state your name for the record. Indicate your support or opposition for SGR 3 and then proceed with your testimony.
Eleanor Andrews. I'm against the constitutional amendment. I'm going to take some of my valuable time to tell you who I am. I was on the Judicial Council. I was Commissioner of Administration. I've been on the boards of Chamber of Commerce, Commonwealth North, and every civic organization you can sit in from Anchorage. This system is not broken. As a lay person on the Judicial Council, I had an opportunity to argue with, cajole, convince, negotiate with lawyers. They're smart, but so am I. I don't think they overpower the non-attorney members. And during my time on the commission, I had Governor Murkowski refuse to select from the names that were sent to him, as did Governor Knowles. We had groups of legislators come and threaten us with constitutional amendments and removal of us from the council because they didn't like that somebody didn't get appointed. I have been threatened through the confirmation process about my attitude and why I would not be confirmed. My feeling is that what we have now provides for justice. And that's really all I care about. Somebody's going to always feel like their oxen is gored, pardon me. But our system works. I don't think we need to change anything that's been a model system for the whole United States.
Thank you, Ms. Andrews. Let's keep it at a minute. I will, just to make sure we can keep moving through, I will ask our operator to silence it at 1 minute, and you're welcome to provide your testimony in writing to us by emailing it to senate.judiciary@akleg.gov. Next, David Landry, please introduce yourself for the record. Welcome, and state your support or opposition to SJR 3 at the beginning of your testimony, please.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. My name is David Landry. I'm a construction contractor in Anchorage, Alaska. I oppose SJR 3. I think Senator Michiki, I geeked out this weekend and listened to the transcripts while I was paying subcontractors of your last meeting. I listened to the recording, and Senator Michiki hit on two things. The use of lawyers in the selection process is a wise use of expertise. And that's for people that claim that they want to run government more like a business, limiting that in any way is a rook business move, and it's not how businesses work. So you have the expertise of the lawyers, which is invaluable. And I also do not believe that any kind of legislative confirmation of these people is going to be a political litmus test. So that's my minute. I'm opposed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Landry. We appreciate your input and for respecting the 1 minute. Next is Eric McCollum. Please introduce yourself for the record and state your opposition or support for SJR 3 and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Eric McCallum. I am opposed to SJ number 3. I am the owner of Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, who supplies the slope and construction and fishing for the last 35 years. I'm also the main investor in Triverist LLC, who just got a multi-million dollar contract to supply aircraft cleaning deck equipment to the Navy. So when in business, you don't fix something that's not broken. It's hard enough to fix things that are broken. And I think we have record of, 40 years of this working, because there's only been maybe 1% of the time that the Chief Justice has had to break a tie. And, so to me, I would much rather have this committee and all of that smart brain cells down there working on fixing the budget and coming up with a budget we can all agree on. We had the advantage when we wrote this Constitution to have a bunch of smart people, but we also had the advantage of having all the other states do it before, and so we were able to see and learn from the mistakes that they've made. I'm from Ohio. We elect judges there, and it hasn't worked out very well at all. I'd like to keep one.
Thank you very much, Mr. McCollum. Please feel free to submit your testimony to senate.judiciary@akleg.gov. Next, we're going to go to Fairbanks to Joe Miller. Welcome, Mr. Miller, to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Please state your name for the record and indicate your support or opposition to SJR 3 at the beginning of your testimony.
My name is Joe Miller. I support SJR 3. Many of you probably know, as a state and federal U.S. magistrate judge, I've been an acting district court judge, a lawyer in the state for well over two decades. So I've applied for a judgeship. My wife also sat on the Judicial Council. I've asked everyone here, why are there so many lawyer jokes? There's a fairly negative perspective of lawyers and culture. It's a biased demographic. It's a very small percentage of our community that controls the outcome of judicial selections. And it's not just that 4-3 vote that you guys have talked about. It's also a matter of staff selection, reports that are generated by the council. That has a tremendously influential part in the process. And so there needs to be that democratic control. The judiciary was the branch that our founders feared most. We need to take the time to make this change. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe. And next we'll go to Carol Carmen in Palmer. Welcome, Ms. Carmen. Please state your name for the record and indicate your support or opposition to SJR 3 at the beginning of your testimony.
My name is Carol Carmen. I support SJR 3. I agree with Senator Mike Schauer that more oversight is needed, and I agree with his other comments regarding bias and politics getting involved. I also agree with Senator Laura Reinbold that I'd prefer judges be elected. But this is, as Senator Schauer said, this is a baby step, and I totally agree with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us today. In Wasilla, Wes Keller, welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Please state your name for the record and indicate your support or opposition to SJR 3 before continuing with your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Wes Keller. Greetings to all of you. Thank you, Senator Sellers, for sponsoring this crucial legislation. I'm not being overstating here. I'm not being melodramatic. I'm for the bill, by the way. I'm not being melodramatic when I say that this could be the most critical issue on the docket this year in the legislature. In fact, it may be even it might be the biggest one in your career. And the reason I say that, it's not overstatement, is that it's about, it really is about who you are in terms of your constitutional powers. And that's important to me because you act on my behalf. Your authority is my authority. A lot has already been said that is really good, but I just want to say that SGR 3 addresses a potentially fatal flaw in our Constitution. We have an imbalance of powers in the state of Alaska. I could go on and on and on. A minute is really, I feel limited. I could talk about that for a long time. SGR 3 just tweaks that flaw in the Constitution. It won't solve all of our problems, but it's the only game out there. It's going in the right direction, and it's really an important one. SGR 3 merely does, all it does is give the legislature the right to say no and to cause open and sunshine and debate on who the appointees are. And in politics, in that sense, in debate and searching for the truth, is a good thing, you know, and I think we tend
to... Thank you very much, Wes. We appreciate your testimony. We're trying to be respectful, so keeping at that 1 minute, so I encourage you to please... consider submitting your testimony in writing to senate.judiciary@akleg. We're going to go to Nome to John. Let's see, I need glasses for this one, and I still may pronounce it wrong. Beoff, John, in Nome, please welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Please state your name for the record. Indicate your support or opposition for SJR 3 at the beginning of your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Bioff. I'm here on behalf of Quirk Incorporated, which is the regional Native nonprofit consortium in the Bering Strait region, which is comprised of 20 federally recognized tribal governments and all of their tribal members. And we've submitted a opposition to SJR 3 signed by the Board of Directors. So that is the people, as we've talked about last week and today, not just a bunch of lawyers that are opposing this. The reason they're opposing it is because they're wanting to make sure that politics does not enter into this process. And I know there's been some discussion that, you know, this is not about politics, but truly it really is by subjecting this. The bottom line is that we think that the current process allows subject matter experts who are attorneys to have a say in this, as well as citizens of the state of Alaska side by side, and we think it's not broken. It doesn't need to be fixed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Next, Lynette Clark out of Fairbanks. Welcome to Senate Judiciary. Please state your name for the record, indicate your support or opposition before proceeding with your testimony.
Thank you. I am Lynette Clark from Fox, Alaska, and I am in full support of SJR 3. I think that the example that you can see in the lower 48 of judicial activism has filtered its way into our courts. I am one of those people covered under Article 1, Section 1 and 2, and I see this as a way to be better represented by those folks that we place our trust in, both the House and the Senate. I thank Senator Schauer for bringing this to the committee. I think it's a way to curb the judicial activism in our courts. It has been prevalent in a national level, and it's, like I said earlier, eking its way into our courts now. I support this. I want to see this pass. I want that part of my voice of Article 1, Section 1 and 2 to be honored. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony this afternoon. Larry Barsikoff, welcome to Senate Judiciary Committee. Please state your name for the record, indicate your support or opposition, excuse me, to SJR 3 at the beginning of your testimony.
Thank you very much. Larry Barsikoff, JD, MBA, Director of Operations for the Alaska Policy Forum. I am in support of the policy that requires legislative confirmation of all members of the Judicial Council. Judicial reform is an esoteric topic. The process by which judges are selected for their positions is not something that most voters get excited about. I consider myself an informed voter. I mean, public policy is my day job. But I have to confess that fully researching a list of 10 or a dozen judges during retention votes is not a high priority. Instead, I defer to the judgment of the Judicial Council. So if I defer to the judgment of the Judicial Council, I ask the members of the committee to imagine your average voter. They also are trusting the judgment of the Judicial Council. So we know that members of the council, you know, those industry insiders have natural advantage over members of the public. They know their industry. They are the experts. Members of the public tend to rely on industry members for their expert industry knowledge. So this I'll lay out to show you the power of those individual members, especially those selected by the Bar Association. It's a great power. The founders of the United States worked hard to dilute authority in the same way the authors of the Alaska Constitution sought to ensure sovereign authority remained in the citizens of Alaska. Because Alaskans are the source of sovereign.
Thank you, Larry. I encourage you, please submit your testimony in writing to senate.judiciary@akleg.gov. I have one more person looks like they're here on my screen. Walter Carpinetti, welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Please state your name and indicate your support or opposition before proceeding with the rest of your testimony. Oh, I'm sorry. You're in the room. It says in room right here. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Walter Carpinetti. I oppose SJR3. Addressing just a couple of points, the sponsor, Senator Schauer, today said three attorneys and the Chief Justice can determine on their own all the judges. I'm taking that as the basic statement of the problem that we have. I mean, my first inclination is to ask, this system has worked very well for 60 years. What's the problem that needs fixing? And I take it that's it. Or former Representative Keller's statement, there's a potentially fatal flaw. We're talking about something that could go wrong. That's as I understand it. But when I look at the history, I ask, has that happened? Have three lawyers and the Chief Justice, who, by the way, has in every case in our state's history been confirmed by a majority of the statewide voters before becoming Chief Justice? That's just the way it's worked out. Have those four people taken over the power? And when you look at the facts, they just haven't. The council since 84 has voted on 1,389 candidates. 80%, more than 80% of those votes have been either 5-1 or 6-0. They work well together. That doesn't suggest a system that's not working well. Secondly, there's been 75 ties, 3-3. That's 5% of the votes. And of those ties, only 19 have been all of the attorneys on one side and all the non-attorneys on the other. So those two instances, the 75 total ties and the 19 perfect ties, we'll call them, have called for the Chief Justice to vote. In those instances, the Chief Justice votes to send the name on 75% of the time. It just doesn't seem to me to be a system that has any problems. The second thing I'd say is, I agree, all power resides in the people. And what that means is that we can change the Constitution if we think it should be changed. That's what you're debating now. But I don't agree with the follow-up statement that was recently made, but the branch that is supposed to balance the other branches has no check itself. That's just not right. The legislature can and often does overturn statutory decisions. It has the power of the purse. The governor has the veto power. The Bar Association itself is created by you, by the legislature. The Board of Governors has three public members on it. There are a lot of checks and balances. And so I'm probably over. If I am, please tell me.
You are, and the operator can't turn you off. So okay. If you could please make a closing statement, and it looks like you have some things in writing there, and you'd be very welcome to submit it to us, too.
I have a lot more I could say if you want me to. But the point that I was making is the legislature and the governor have a lot of power over the court system. It's not accurate to say there's no balance. The question is, the balance that we have now be upset? And my recommendation would be is that it shouldn't be. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I'm sorry to have gone on.
Thank you, Mr. Carpinetti. We appreciate your coming in person and speaking with us today. And so I'm not seeing anyone else on the list. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to speak regarding SJR 3? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. And want to thank all of those that signed up to speak to us today. We're going to set this bill aside and bring it back later, but I did want to mention to my fellow committee members that if you'd like to offer an amendment, please have your amendment to my office by 6 p.m. tomorrow. So now we're going to move on to SJR 5, Constitutional Amendment Permanent Funded Dividend, sponsored by the governor. We were given a bill introduction and open and closed public testimony on April 8th, and today we're bringing the bill back for the purpose of offering amendments, and it is my intention to move the bill out of the committee today if it is indeed the will of the committee. So we are ready for amendments. So Senator Keel, would you like to offer your amendment, please? Your number one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move amendment number one.
And I will object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think discussion is a great place to start. This amendment does two things. And I'm certainly open to discussion with the rest of the committee about their scope and the size of the two things it does. But the first, and I think the single most important thing this does, is it brings us to a constitutional percent of market value. So it calculates the market value based on both the corpus and the earnings reserve. Excuse me. And sets, using some, I think, tested language, sets a 5% maximum draw. I think it's, you know, the preceding five fiscal years average. At the same time, it maintains the earnings reserve structure. In fact, it constitutionalizes it so that if we were to have a run of bad years, you can't get into what we think of as the corpus of the fund. So while we calculate the POMV on the total value, there is an added protection for what's been put in the principal over time. And then what amendment number one does, having, I think, really thoroughly protected the fund in the Constitution and ensured in the long term that it's safe from inflation and it's safe from overdraw by a future legislature, is then it puts a minimum split between dividends and what could potentially be used for public services. I proposed in this one part, no less than one part dividends, no more than three parts for public services. And certainly that's up for discussion. In any year when you don't need the three parts for services, whether we have a great run-up in oil prices or a great run-up in production, more could be put on the dividend side. We could certainly maintain the statutory formula we have now that would comply with this language without needing a tweak, because, of course, it's more than one-quarter dividends. But that way, we ensure that the Alaska voters always have a PFD they can count on, and that we're also able to meet the needs of the public through the services the state provides. So those are the two things contained in Amendment 1.
Are there questions regarding Amendment Number 1? So just to be clear, this is essentially would be establishing a 25-75 split of the POMV draw. Is that, in very basic terms, what this amendment is doing?
I think the way to look at it, Madam Chair, is never less than 25% dividends. And certainly we could pay the statutory formula under this language.
What we've been referring to as the historical formula?
Right, because 50 is not less than 25. So never less than 25% dividends. If we went to 50% for dividends, that certainly meets this language. I should say if we stuck at the historic formula.
Okay. So what I am seeing is basically the a quarter is being shall be transferred for the purpose of dividend payments. But you're saying you could still pay the historical formula, so help me wrap my brain around that.
Sure, Madam Chair. So on Amendment 1, if you look at that first page, and what you're seeing the quarter there, lines 18 to 21. So drawing 5%, 1 1/4, shall be transferred, constitutionally shall be transferred for the program of dividend payments. Now, the remainder, so that's one part, the remaining three parts, 3 3/4%, may be appropriated by the legislature. So certainly within the power of the legislature to appropriate that for permanent fund dividends. In fact, if things were rip-roaring and glory days were here again financially, we could put 100% into PFDs under this language without violating the Constitution. But never could we spend, could we put less than a quarter of that 5% draw into dividends.
Okay, so as compared to the bill or the resolution as it stands that the governor's proposing, is there would be that transfer of earnings into the dividends according to the historical formula at this point, whereas what you're proposing would only guarantee, as far as a guarantee, not a choice of the legislature, whatever the quarter of the draw equates to is in relationship to the historical formula. Of course, that would change from year to year, but would give the legislature the option to bring it up to the historical formula. So the bill guarantees the historical formula. Yours does not. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. So the governor's guarantees the historical formula and locks us into the way the dividend is calculated. So eligibility stuff and all of the details that we were talking about in our first hearing of the bill that were fairly confusing. This I think keeps it cleaner. This requires that 25% of the draw to go into the dividends, and it's that point at which the legislature's hands are tied. There is no option to get at that 25%. As opposed to the governor's, which would tie our hands at 50% and the old formula. So if there's a need to adjust eligibility and the like, then you get into all the difficulties in SJR 5 as submitted.
And I just have another technical question, just so I understand this. This is my first look at this. So on page 2, section C, starting on line 2, is this constitutionalizing the POMV essentially, and is it structured similarly to what is in statute now, or is it different?
Madam Chair, this does go to a constitutional POMV, yes, and it's very similar in terms of its structure, in that it looks at the average value over the first 5 of the preceding 6 fiscal years. So essentially you're looking at 5 years of audited value. You know exactly what you're talking about. You calculate the value of both the corpus and the earnings reserve, and you do maintain that corpus earnings reserve split in case of a long string of down years in the investment markets. You can't hit the historical principle, as it were. So that all of those, I would say, are relatively similar. I thought it was valuable not to erase the earnings reserve corpus distinction, but still to go to otherwise a full POMV.
Okay, thank you. And as far as the 5%, we're getting the 5% by adding up the 1 1/4 and the 3 3/4 on page 1 to get the 5%. This year we're at 5.25%, and it drops to 5%. Do you happen to know when that drop to 5% occurs, because you're going right with the 5% here?
Madam Chair, I don't. One of our colleagues is signaling it's 2021, which I think works relatively well, since this would go on before the voters in a general election in 2020. And so it would take effect effectively for our first fiscal year would be FY21.
Okay, so then it sounds like it does align with the statute. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions or maybe comments. I see where Senator Kill's going with this, and on the broad 60,000-foot view, I'm not necessarily opposed. I would add one of my concerns, having looked at the amendment this afternoon and not having time to really dive into it. This, and the reason is because of this, we're having the broader discussion about the entire POMV structure, combining the corpus or not, with the earnings reserve account. There are many things at play here, and if we even go down that path, because I know the wiggle room with the legislature, so well, they shall pay one quarter. Well, guess what? We're going to pay for the dividend, one quarter. I can see where that's going to head already. So not really comfortable with that, and I know that's not the intent. I totally get that, but I'm not sure I would be comfortable leaving the shall pay or may be appropriated in the hands of the legislature. That's one concern I have outright with the language. And the second one, like I said, is I think this is a very big, very deep and a discussion we're still having right now as far as the POMV and where we head with that, or even if we go that way. And I think there may be a lot of unintended consequences, so I would have a hard time supporting it, not because of the debate of the topic area, and if we go that way, I think this may be almost a separate thing, even above and beyond SJR5 as we have the conversation. So I just wanted to put that on the record there.
And I would add to that as well, leaving only the shell being for 25% of that POMV going toward PFDs without a spending cap, without an appropriation limit. I think that may appropriate the remainder of what would be the historical formula would be, the chances would be incredibly slim. Senator Reinbold, did you have anything? Senator Keel?
To your point and the related point by Senator Schauer, I'll just reflect that the Constitution right now, the shall on PFDs is zero. 0%, $0. And the restriction on overdrawing the earnings reserve isn't. We can take the entire balance of the earnings reserve in a single year. So I appreciate that, you know, we're all looking at how best to protect the PFD. And where that floor belongs, but the history is that there is no requirement constitutionally to pay a permanent fund dividend at all, and legislatures in the past have been paying it out.
I appreciate that, Senator Keel, and since we're taking a stab at trying to put something in the Constitution, it's an important decision. So, yes, it's an improvement because it's not in the Constitution at all. But if we have a chance to get it at the historical formula, I think that is something we should look at. Also, as far as I do appreciate constitutionalizing in the protection of the earnings reserve, I think there's been a lot of discussion and concern. We wouldn't want that to be eroded and blown. That could happen if it's not protected. I do think that in itself is probably a more appropriate conversation at the finance table, however. So, Senator Reinbold.
Through the chair, would you be open for an amendment on line 18 and also on 22 for a 50%?
Madam Chair, I personally think 50-50 is a little high, but you know it's the committee's amendment. It's certainly in order.
Senator Reinbold.
So I guess I would like to offer a conceptual amendment for those lines, so it's a 50-50 split, and that would be on line 18 and on line 22. So on line 18, it would say 50%, and on instead, you know, delete the 1/4.
It would say 2.5% on each place.
Yeah.
2.5%.
2.5.
So Senator Reinbold, on line 18, it would say equal to 2.5% of the average market value, and on line 22 it would say not to exceed 2.5% of the average market value. That your intention that they be?
What? I'm not going to offer the amendment. Sorry.
Okay, she is withdrawing the conceptual amendment. So, is there further discussion, Senator Schauer?
Madam Chair, you're right. There's a number of discussions, and certainly happened around the finance table. And there's probably a half a dozen plans floating around about how to do this. And then, of course, what the administration might, you know, hope to do on their own, because they've got their own things they're looking at or obviously proposing in this resolution. And like I said, I like the general direction of where it's potentially going, but as we've talked about, a minimum of a 50-50 versus statute and constitution, I've made it very clear that I don't necessarily trust language in the statute because we don't follow it. So there's a lot of maybe unintended consequences with this that I'm just not prepared yet today to throw my name behind, and as we were having this broader debate. And like I said, I hope Senator Keel understands that. I appreciate the direction in trying to do this. I'm just not ready to look at all these plans in aggregate and pull them together on where we're going to head and what might have support. So I'm not ready to do that yet today. I don't want to throw that out there because there's so many discussions, and then how we're going to protect the earnings reserve itself, whether it should be protected, combined with the corpus. There's just a lot of things at play. So, again, I appreciate the discussion greatly, and I think we're moving in the right direction, but the right protection for the permanent fund and the dividend is going to be a really big battle and very well thought out in the end. So I'm just not there yet. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and I'm encouraged that the sponsor of the amendments brought this forward to know that he would like something in the Constitution to make it clear that the PFD would go forward. So I appreciate that factor. Are there any other comments before I remove my objection? Or maintain my objection, I'm sorry. And we go to a vote, I'm sorry. If I removed it, I have a feeling someone else would declare one. So, Senator Machicki, did you have any comments regarding amendment number one?
No, Madam Chair.
All right, I will maintain my amendment and would request that the...
Your objection.
I mean my objection. Oh, actually, you know, I am maintaining it. But I would like to bring Mr. Barnhill up just to make comments on this, if I could. I meant to do that a little earlier.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mike Barnhill, Office of Management, Budget Policy Director. So comments of the administration with respect to Senator Keel. Appreciate the amendment. What the governor has put forward in SJR 5 is a vehicle that amends the Constitution to do two primary things. One, guarantee the payment of the permanent fund dividend as set out in statute. So right now we have a situation where we have a statute, but the payment's not guaranteed because it's subject to appropriation. This amendment would basically wipe that purpose out of this resolution. And so the statutory formula would not, as it exists today or as it exists in the future, would not be guaranteed. It would be subject to the legislature making ad hoc decisions every year and going forward. The second purpose of the resolution as introduced by the governor is to give the people the ability to consider any changes to that statutory formula going forward. So there's freedom for the legislature to change it. And if the legislature wanted to move away from the statutory formula as it presently exists to a 50-50 or whatever, the people would have the ability to consider that. And that purpose is also eliminated by this amendment. And so both of the primary purposes of the governor in introducing this resolution are eliminated by the amendment, and for that reason, respectfully, we would prefer the committee not adopt it.
I am not surprised by that position. Thank you, Mr. Barnhill. Any questions for him? Thank you. And so I'm maintaining my objection, and so I'd like to ask the Senate Secretary to please call the roll.
Senator Machicki?
No.
Senator Keel?
Yes.
Senator
Barnhill? No.
No.
Chair Hughes?
No.
One yay.
So on a vote of one yay and four nays, the amendment fails. And we will take up moving on to Senator Schauer. Amendment number, I'm seeing it's Senator Machicki and Senator Schauer. Senator Machicki, are you the lead on this one?
Yes, I'm ready to go. Madam Chair, I move amendment number two, which is co-sponsored by me and Senator Schauer.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment does a few things. Mostly it's cleanup. There's only one thing that's substantive. And the first page one, line 15, deletes the words "a program of," which is just unnecessary language. So now the sentence would read, "A portion of the income from the permanent fund shall be transferred slowly for dividend payments." It's not a program of, it's going to be a direct transfer. So this is part of that direct transfer change, which you see in the next section of the amendment, page 2, lines 2 and 3. It changes the words, "an appropriation under section 13 of this article is not necessary for a transfer under this subsection," to "the transfer of income for the payment of dividends to state residents under this subsection does not require an appropriation under section 13 of the article." So an appropriation will no longer be necessary. It's simply a transfer, and it reorders those words so it actually works the way I believe it was intended by the sponsors. The next is page 2, line 5. Again, it's taking out that program of dividend payments and changing it to "amount transferred for the payment of dividends." And then finally, on page 2, lines 6 and 7, it takes out "including the amount of the dividend and eligibility requirements." And since we're already talking about dividend payments, it eliminates that section and goes right to "shall not take effect unless approved by the voters of the state." So it was redundant. It's covered by the dividend payments in the earlier subsection, Madam Chair. But what it does substantively is it removes eligibility requirements from the constitutional amendment, which we believe should remain under the purview of the legislature.
Thank you. Are there comments or questions for the sponsor of the amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you. Just briefly, I wanted to add to the last comment on eligibility. I think it's important because one of the things we were concerned with was enshrining a right or what might be set as a court precedent with rights if you said you had eligibility for certain programs within the state and where that might go. So that was a bit concerning to us. So not only do we think it needs to stay, those tools need to stay within the toolbox available to the legislature for eligibility requirements as we may tighten up the program over the years as things change, but we were concerned as well as what path that may take if you started that, you know, like, for example, I have an eligibility for any number of things and where that might go. So I just wanted to add that in that last one we thought was very important. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe a mechanical question, and I didn't get this ahead of time, so it probably has an obvious answer. The transfer for the payment of dividends doesn't require an appropriation, but then at lines 4, 5, 6, a law that would amend the amount transferred for the payment of dividends. So if the amount gets transferred for the payment, what's a law that changes the amount that gets transferred?
Madam Chair, should
Senator Machicki please respond?
Yeah, thank you. That, again, if this were to pass, would require it going to the voters for a change in the amount that's going to be transferred. That's kind of what we're saying. There's a lot of extra words that talk about the amount of the payment and things like that. This supports the original statutory payment that was in existence when, as December 31st of 2018. So if that is changed, that is the change that must go before the voters. So we're all talking about the same thing. What's existing is the statutory payment on the last day of last year is what's in this right now. And if the legislature decides they're going to try to change it, that amount must go before the voters.
Follow up.
Senator Keel.
Just trying to sort of work through potential other consequences in my head. I thank you for that one. If we changed, the legislature changed the allowable investment list, or actually maybe we have done away with the investment list. We used to have a list of allowable investments, and that changes what we can expect to earn on the fund. Does that have the effect of changing the amount to be transferred? Does that have to go to the voters?
Madam Chairman.
Senator Michiki.
In my interpretation, it does not. I don't know if the administration wants to weigh in. What this is supporting is the five-year trailing earnings and the percentage of that those earnings that go to the people, the traditional statutory calculation, which does not change how we can invest the earnings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the intent. I lingering question about the whether that has that impact.
Senator, Mr. Barnhill, if you'd come up and just respond to this conversation between Senator Michiki and Senator Keel.
Happy to. Again, Mike Barnhill, OMB. So to Senator Keel's question, the investment list statutes, when we had them, were set out in Title 37, governing how the permanent fund invests the assets of the permanent fund corporation invests the assets of the permanent fund. The program for the permanent fund dividend is set out in Title 43, so it's completely separate issues, and nothing in this resolution is intended to go to issues that are governed by statute in Title 37. That is how the investments are managed.
Mr. Barnhill, did you have a follow-up question to that, Senator Keel?
Just that the amendment deletes the word program. So, okay.
Well, Madam Chair, to attempt to clarify it further, we have a program of dividends, and we have a program of investments. And investments are in Title 37. Dividends are in Title 43, completely separate. And just to make it patently clear, the governor does not intend for this resolution to touch anything regarding the management of permanent fund assets.
Mr. Barnhill, just in general, as far as the amendment, does the administration support the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. We have no objection to the amendment that is drafted. I think it provides some cleanup, and then substantively it eliminates the words dividend or eligibility, and I think that's fine.
All right. And we did, thank you very much. We did have that conversation at the table regarding eligibility, and I think the voters are more concerned about the PFD itself, and they're already eligible. So if we change that, tweak that, I don't think the voters would mind that, or the people of Alaska. So thank you, Mr. Barnhill. Are there any other questions for him? Or any comments or questions in general from the committee? Any wrap-up comments, Senator Michiki?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. I will remove my objection then. Are there any further objections?
Madam Chair, I'm still concerned and would like to work on this particular little question going forward, but I will not object to the amendment right now.
All right. And seeing no further objections, the amendment is thereby adopted. Moving on to amendment number 3. Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number 3.
And I will object for purposes of discussion.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. This was brought to me by a member of the Permanent Fund Defenders, Mr. Clem Tillian, and he has a very specific reason for doing that. And it took me a little while to get there, but I believe it is beneficial. What this amendment does is it inserts the words on page 2, line 3, following subsection, inserts the words dividend payments under this subsection shall be distributed in 4 equal quarterly payments over the calendar year. Essentially, what this is the same amount of the statutory calculation. It is the same dividend size. It is simply distributed in 4 equal parts. And I can answer any questions as to why that may be beneficial if you'd like, or however you'd like to handle it.
Please do.
Yeah, and we had research done by a member of the administration that unfortunately claimed that about 10% of dividends are make it into the economy and state. We believe that the smaller quarterly payments will be more likely to end up in the economy at a much higher proportion. We believe this will be at a lower cost to the state because the remaining dollars will continue to earn over the course of the year. and we believe it will reduce some of the more negative behavior that occurs from a very small subset of the residents of the state of Alaska when they get a really big check in one place. They often don't use it for what's best for them, their families, or their communities. So it's not the government managing the money, it's just simply paying the same amount over four quarters. One quarter of the amount over four quarters.
Okay. Are there any other are there questions, Senator Michiki?
Or Senator Schauer?
I mean, Senator Schauer. Question for Senator Michiki.
Madam Chair, I'll make him go again if you'd like. I have no problem with that. I want to add a couple of things because I support this, and I this hasn't really come out into the public consciousness, I don't think, yet, and I would be curious to see, only because I'm curious, if the citizenry would support it. It's one of those things that you look at and go, and at the broad topic level, this or the high level, this does seem to make sense, everything Senator Michiki said. I think we did math before on this and said something, it could be as high as $270 million extra based on the interest of keeping it in the bank longer that the state could earn, which long-term is a benefit for everybody. But there were a few other things we didn't that weren't mentioned as well. The economic impact, as ICER had the study that we went through in finance, and you see a big hump about October and November. There's a big spike for economic impacts, and then it kind of goes away. And everybody goes, oh, well, you get a bump in earnings, and then it just there's not really an impact after that in the economy. And one of the things that I actually asked him when the professor was here and talked about it, and he actually said that. He's like, yeah, that would be interesting because it should smooth out over the course of the year, and you have people that would need it for various things. So you would actually, in some ways, you could almost look at it like, you know, for the disabled and the senior citizen. There comes their Social Security check every month. Every 3 months, you would have another check of whatever amount coming in that would help with that income. And so there are a number of very positive aspects. And so far as we have been, for lack of a better term, wargaming this in the office, we have not been able to find a negative thing that this would do to the economy. And we actually think it would keep, like you said, more money in the economy longer. But I think we would find that for especially the lower income Alaskans that are struggling, this is one of the things the dividend helps the most, this program, would have that money coming in at times where it would be very useful and not just racked up all at once. So there's other tax possible benefits for it, stretching it out. It's just a number of things. So I want to throw that out there that as the public is listening to this and thinking about it, to be very clear, this isn't, you're not getting less money, getting the exact same amount. You're spreading it out over the year, which might be a very good benefit to the small businesses, et cetera, et cetera. So I think this is something that we really should take a look at because I think this could be a really good thing for the state. People.
Are there other comments? Senator Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm thinking this through. I don't know if I can claim to war game it, but I'll do my best. Couple of, I guess, questions. I assume those for whom, and we've all heard public comments on the budget where people say it's extra money for their household, they don't need it. I assume those folks are just going to choose their direct deposit account to be their kids 529 or their retirement, so that we're not going to change their behavior. For folks who have bills that the PFD helps them pay or get caught up. Question, I guess, about how the executive branch will handle the garnishments issue. Does that get harder, easier, stay the same if we go to four instead of one payment a year? Child support, debts, all the things that, you know, PFDs get garnished for.
Senator Michiki.
Thank you. I'll leave it up to the administration if they'd like to answer. However, I have had conversations, and the reality of it is it's relatively unchanged. The difference is that you're going to, for those getting an electronic check, which is the vast majority of people today, of course, it's just a couple of keystrokes. For those that receive physical checks, there will be some minor cost to the state, but as far as the garnishments, it would be the same garnishments spread out over the year. So if they may have a smoother way of explaining that, but my understanding is it didn't create an adverse impact.
Mr. Barnhill.
Through the chair, members of the committee, so we have looked at this in another context, and we've looked at it not in terms of quarterly payments, but monthly payments. for many of the reasons identified by the sponsor of the amendment. My understanding, and this is indirect from the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, and they're really the ones that are the experts on this, that there would be an increase in the burden, but I'm not sure that it's sufficient enough to warrant setting this aside. I think there are a lot of benefits to considering a multi-period payment approach here. And then to the specific wording of the amendment, since we were considering monthly payments, perhaps a friendly amendment to consider is to say shall be distributed in no less than 4 equal payments, so the state would have the option of going monthly if we wanted. Now, I will say the other context was in the context of the PFD hold harmless context. And so we were thinking about doing this statutorily rather than in the Constitution. That's really within the purview of this committee to decide whether it's better to take this up constitutionally or statutorily. But certainly the reasons offered are meritorious.
And so with that statement, can I assume that the administration is fine with this amendment as well?
We'll take no position on it and offer no objection and leave it to the will of the committee.
Did I hear you indicate that if the words no less than were inserted before 4 equal quarterly payments, that might be a preference?
I think so, Madam Chair. My concern is if this went into the Constitution as drafted and we wanted to go monthly, the language as drafted might prohibit us from doing that. And so rather than tie our hands.
Senator Michiki?
So you may have remembered a visit by a man named Mark Zuckerberg. Quarterly payments is significantly different than the minimum basic income concepts of monthly payments. I think you start getting into the Zuckerberg model, which is an extremely leftist and model, and one that I have a very difficult time supporting. This is specifically breaking it into quarters. I think the monthly aspect is a very different vision than the one I had with the quarterly payments, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Michiki. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll stay neutral on that part because I'm not going to go down the Zuckerberg trail. I actually hadn't thought about that either direction. But I will say I just wanted to answer a little bit to Senator Keel's question because this did come in finance this morning, actually. And the question was asked of the PFD representative, the corporation, and as far as it was related to another bill, and as far as all garnishments, et cetera, everything basically would not change. They always take priority via the law. So I don't think anything we would do here would override how the process or the program would work. This would simply break it up into some amount of payments during the course of the year, and that seemed to be pretty straightforward. So thank you.
Are there any? Senator Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another mechanical question. This doesn't trigger anything like income tax withholding, which is not currently done for most PFD recipients, although it is for a few. How does that work?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I'm going to plead ignorance. I have no idea. Sorry.
Senator Michiki?
Yeah, I can help with that. Withholding is based on the amount and not the frequency of distribution. So if you're being withheld today, you're going to be withheld. If you're not being withheld today, you're not going to be withheld.
All right. I'm not seeing any further questions or comments. So I will remove my objection. Are there any further objections? Seeing none, amendment number 3 has been adopted. Amendment number 4, I'm going to ask my judiciary buddy Witt to come to the table, please, for this one. And I will move amendment number 4. Senator Schauer?
Madam Chair, I'll object for purposes of explanation.
All right, we'll let Mr. Witt get situated. This stems from a concern of mine. That I don't want us painting ourselves into the corner. We have a volatile oil market, and if prices were to drop substantially, and we did not have a spending limit in place, and we had a constitutional amendment to pay a certain amount of PFDs, we might back ourselves into a corner. And so we were inquiring about adding contingency language that this amendment would not be added to the Constitution, basically, unless the spending limit appropriation, SJR 6, were also approved by the voters. And in doing that, we heard from Ledge Legal, and I'll let Mr. Witt explain a little bit of what we heard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Buddy Witt, staff to Chair Hughes. As the Chair stated, we're looking to a way to for numerous concerns from a financial policy point of view, tie the SGR 5 to a previous bill that was in committee, the spending cap constitutional amendment. We approached the subject in two different ways, one of which we were almost certain was not constitutional, and the second of which we thought might work. And sure enough, we asked the legal minds at Legislative Legal to weigh in on the contingency language that basically said on page 2, line 24, that if the with the 2020 amendments to the Alaska Permanent Fund were contingent upon the passage relating to an appropriation limit. They said that was unconstitutional, that we had numerous issues, the probably not the least of which was tying an Alaskan's vote on one ballot initiative to another, raised some very serious concerns. So it was the Chair's idea to at least bring this forward and start the conversation so that we would then pull it back and talk about the second approach to this very issue.
And and for that reason, I'm withdrawing amendment number 4 at this time. So I didn't want to set us up in a way that we'd have problems in the courts with that. And in my earlier explanation, I did not indicate clearly that when I said I didn't want to paint ourselves in a corner or back ourselves in a corner, and if oil prices were low, I didn't want to put us in a forced situation where we'd have to raise exorbitant taxes in order to meet our obligations, and that's why the spending limit is so crucial. And so, therefore, I move amendment number 5. Senator Schauer.
Madam Chair, I'll object for purposes of explanation.
So I'll just in general, and then I'll hand it over to Mr. Witt. Because the contingency language was a problem, Legislative Legal actually suggested this might be a better solution, and that is actually to bring the language from SR 6 and merge it into SJR 5, and that is in essence what this does. One of the questions was how the courts have ruled as far as single subject rule, and they've not yet had a case regarding a constitutional amendment in this regard, but they have for bills, and as long as there is an overarching general topic such as state finances for bills, that has the courts have allowed that. So the thought is, even though it hasn't been tested as far as constitutional amendments, that this would stand up better, much more likely than our effort in amendment number 4. So, Buddy, do you want to speak to amendment number 5, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And basically, this takes the language in SJR 6, the appropriation limit, as it passed out of this committee, and inserts it into SJR 5, tying them both together for both an appropriation limit and the permanent fund dividend.
Right, and I understand the administration, even though both of these resolutions are part of what they're calling, I believe, their fiscal plan, their preference is to keep them separate. I understand there's concern when you put two things, it could be a bit confusing, but I believe Alaskans are smart. Voters can get this, and I also believe voters would be concerned about setting ourselves up for high tax rates in the future. So I think that this is something that the voters would want to see on the ballot and would possibly support, I would think. So are there any questions regarding the amendment? Senator Keel.
Madam Chair, my memory may be failing me, but I thought Legislative Legal Services had some concerns about SJR 6 and the amendment versus revision question.
Mr. Witt, can you speak to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Senator Keel, that is correct. There was quite a conversation in this committee concerning SGR 6 and whether it was an amendment or a revision. Ultimately, the governor's position is that they can effectively argue their position on SGR 6 and that they are prepared to do so. So it was the will of the committee to trust the governor and his position on his bill and move the bill out of committee.
Okay, thank you. Senator Keel?
I vaguely recall the committee may not have been unanimous on that. I'll have to go back and check my notes.
You may be right about that.
But I guess I would think that concern doesn't diminish and probably gets greater as we then look to couple yet more constitutional sections and changes to the legislature's power to appropriate that fundamental authority of the legislative branch together into a single thing. It starts to look like a whole sectional rewrite and an even more significant change in what the people can decide when they vote on legislators every other year. So I think my concern about a revision grows with this one rather than shrinks.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Are there other comments from members? Seeing none, I'm going to remove my objection. Are there any further objections?
Yeah, I have to object this one.
All right, there is an objection. And you've already spoken to it, but do you want to say anything else?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm taken at ease. On the record, and there's been an objection, so if the Secretary would please call the roll.
No.
Senator Reinhold. Senator Shower.
Yes.
Senator Baticki.
Yes.
Chair Hughes.
Yes.
3 yeas, 1 nay, 1 absent.
So on a vote of 1 yea, 1 nay, and 1 absent, the amendment is adopted. 3 yeas. And I believe that is...
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Baticki.
Can you restate that count, please?
So in a vote of 3 yeas, 1 nay, and 1 absent, the amendment is adopted. If I mess that up, I apologize.
A little bit.
Okay. And I believe that is all the amendments that are before us. And so that brings us back to the committee substitute. And I'd like to know what the will of the committee is. Senator Baticki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution 5, Work Order 31-GS1072/U, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Thank you. And hearing no objection, the bill moves from committee. I'd also like to state for the record that legislative legal is authorized to make any technical and conforming changes needed to implement the adopted amendments. And we'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. Later time based on the time and the fact that there are other committees beginning soon. So that will conclude our business today then, and we will adjourn at 3:10 p.m.